Chapter 6. Lisi and the Professor. This is what it gets you. 1. Lisi felt no fear now, and her momentary lapse into amusement had been replaced by hard, clean rage. She left the BMW parked in front of the locked barn doors and strode stilt-legged to the house, wondering if she would find her new friend's missive at the kitchen door or the one in front. She never doubted there would be a missive, and she was right. It was in the back, a white, business-length envelope sticking out from between the screen door and the jamb. Cigarette clamped between her front teeth, Lisi tore the envelope open and unfolded a single sheet of paper. The message was typewritten. Mrs., I am sorry to do this as I love animals, but bitter your cat than you. I don't want to hurt you. I don't want to, but you need to call 412-298-8188 and tell the man that you are donative those papers we talked about to the school library by way of him. We don't want to let any grass grow under our feet on this, Mrs., so call him by 8 p.m. tonight, alt he'll get in touch with me. Let us finigs this business with no one hut except your poor pet, about which I am so sorry. Your friend, Zach. P.S. I'm not a bit mad you told me to go F myself. I know you were upset. Z. Lisi looked at the Z, which was Zach McCool's final bit of communication to her, and thought of Zorro, galloping through the night with his cape billowing out behind him. Her eyes were watering. She thought for a moment that she was crying, then realized it was smoke. The cigarette between her teeth had burned down to the filter. She spat it to the brickwork of the walk and ground it grimly beneath her heel. She looked up at the high, board fence that went all the way around their backyard, though solely for the sake of symmetry, as their only neighbors were on the south side, to Lisi's left, as she stood by her kitchen door with Zach McCool's infuriating, poorly typed missive, his smucking ultimatum, in her hand. It was the Galloways on the other side of the board fence, and the Galloways had half a dozen cats. They were called barn cats in this neck of the woods. They sometimes foraged in the Landon's yard, especially when no one was home. Lisi had no doubt it was a Galloway barn cat in her mailbox, just as she had no doubt it had been Zach in the PT Cruiser that had passed her not long after she finished locking up and left Amanda's house. Mr. PT Cruiser had been heading east, coming almost directly out of the lowering sun, so she hadn't been able to get a good look at him. The bastard even had the balls to tip her a wave. Howdy there, missus, left you a little something in your mailbox. And she had waved back, because that was what you did out here in Sticksville. You bastard, she murmured, so angry she didn't even know which one she was cursing, Zach or the crazed incunk who had sicked Zach on her. But since Zach had so considerately provided her with Woodbody's phone number, she had recognized the Pittsburgh area code instantly. She knew which one she intended to deal with first, and she found she was looking forward to it. But before she dealt with anyone, she had a distasteful housekeeping chore to perform. Lisi stuffed Zach McCool's letter into her back pocket, briefly touching Amanda's little notebook of compulsions without even being aware of it, and yanked out her house keys. She was still too angry to be aware of much, including the possibility of the sender's fingerprints on the letter. Nor was she thinking about calling the county sheriff's office, although that had certainly been on her to-do list earlier. Rage had narrowed coherent thought to something very like the beam of the little flashlight she had used to look into the mailbox, and right now that limited her to just a pair of ideas. Take care of the cat, then call Woodbody and tell him to take care of Zach McCool. To call him off. Or else. 2. From the cabinet under her kitchen sink, she got a pair of floor buckets, some clean rags, an old pair of Playtex rubber gloves, and a garbage bag that she tucked into the back pocket of her jeans. She squirted Top Job into one of the buckets and filled it with hot water, using the sink's handheld spray attachment to make the soap foam up faster. Then she went outside, pausing only to get a pair of tongs out of what Scott had called the kitchen's things drawer, the big ones she used on the rare occasions when she decided to barbecue. She heard herself singing the kick-out line from Jambalaya over and over again as she went about these small, grim chores. Son of a gun, we'll have big fun on the bayou. Big fun, no doubt. Outside, she filled the second bucket with cold rinse from the hose bib and then walked up the driveway, a bucket in each hand, the rags tossed over her shoulder, the long tongs sticking out of one back pocket and the hefty bag in the other. When she got to the mailbox, she set the buckets down and wrinkled her nose. Could she smell blood, or was that only her imagination? She peered into the mailbox. Hard to see. The light was going the wrong way. Should have brought the flash, she thought, but she was damned if she was going to go back and get it. Not while she was strapped and ready. Lisi probed with the tongs, stopping when they hit something that wasn't soft but wasn't quite hard either. She opened them as wide as she could, clamped them down, and pulled. At first nothing happened. Then the cat, really just a sense of weight at the end of her arm, began to move reluctantly forward. The tongs lost their hold and clicked together. Lisi pulled them out. There was blood and a few gray hairs on the spatulate ends, what Scott had always called the grabbers. She remembered telling him grabbers was one fish he might have found floating dead on the surface of his precious pool. That had made him laugh. Lisi bent and peered into the mailbox. The cat had come about halfway and was easy enough to see now. It was a nondescript smoke color, a Galloway barn cat for sure. She clicked the tongs together twice, for luck, and was about to reach in again when she heard a car approaching from the east. She turned with a sinking in her belly. She didn't just think it was Zack returning in his sporty little PT Cruiser. She knew it. He'd pull over and lean out and ask her if she wanted a little hip with that. He'd call it hip. Missus, he'd say, do you want a little hip with that? But it was some kind of SUV and a woman behind the wheel. You're getting paranoid, little Lisi. Probably so, and under the circumstances she had a right to be. Get it done. You came out here to do it, so do it. She reached in with the tongs again, this time looking at what she was doing, and as she opened the grabbers and positioned them around one of the unlucky barn cat's stiffening paws, she thought of Dick Powell in some old black and white movie, carving a turkey and asking, who wants a leg? And yes, she could smell the thing's blood. She gagged a little, bent her head, spat between her sneakers. Get it done. Lisi closed the grabbers, not such a bad word after all, not once you made friends with it, and pulled. She fumbled the green garbage bag open with her other hand, and in the cat tumbled, head first. She twirled the bag closed and knotted the neck, since stupid little Lisi had also forgotten to bring one of the yellow plastic ties. Then she resolutely began to scrub her mailbox clean of the blood and fur. 3. When she was finished with the mailbox, Lisi trudged back down the driveway with her buckets in the long evening light. Breakfast had been coffee and oatmeal, lunch little more than a scoop of tuna and mayo on a scrap of lettuce, and dead cat or no dead cat, she was starved. She decided to put off her call to Woodbody until she had some food in her belly. The thought of calling the sheriff's office, anyone in a blue uniform for that matter, hadn't yet returned to her. She washed her hands for 3 minutes, using very hot water and making sure any speck of blood was gone from under her nails. Then she found the Tupperware dish containing the leftover cheeseburger pie, scraped it onto a plate, and blasted it in the microwave. While she waited for the chime, she hunted a Pepsi out of the fridge. She remembered thinking she'd never finish the hamburger helper stuff once her initial lust for it had been slaked. You could add that to the bottom of the long, long list of things in life Lisi has been wrong about. But so what? Big diddly, as Cantata had been fond of saying in her teenage years. I never claimed to be the brains of the outfit, Lisi told the empty kitchen, and the microwave bleeped as if to second that. The reheated gloop was almost too hot to eat, but Lisi gobbled it anyway, cooling her mouth with fizzy mouthfuls of cold Pepsi. As she was finishing the last bite, she remembered the low whispering sound the cat's fur had made against the tin sleeve of the mailbox, and the weird pulling sensation she'd felt as the body began, reluctantly, to come forward. He must have really crammed it in there, she thought, and Dick Powell once more came to mind, black and white Dick Powell, this time saying, and have some stuffing. She was up and rushing for the sink so fast, she knocked her chair over. Sure, she was going to vomit everything she'd just eaten. She was going to blow her groceries, toss her cookies, throw her heels, donate her lunch. She hung over the sink, eyes closed, mouth open, midsection locked and straining. After a pregnant 5-second pause, she produced one monstrous cola burp that buzzed like a cicada. She leaned there a moment longer, wanting to make absolutely sure that was all. When she was, she rinsed her mouth, spat, and pulled Zach McCool's letter from her jeans pocket. It was time to call Joseph Woodbody. 4. She expected to reach his office at Pitt. Who'd give a Looney Tune like her new friend Zach his home phone number? And she was prepared to leave what Scott might have called a hugely provocative message on Woodbody's answering machine. Instead, the telephone was answered on the second ring, and a woman's voice, quite pleasant and perhaps lubricated by that all-important first-before-dinner drink, told Lisi that she had reached the Woodbody residence and then asked who was calling. For the second time that day, Lisi identified herself as Mrs. Scott Landon. "I'd like to speak to Professor Woodbody," she said. Her voice was mild and pleasant. "May I say what this is regarding?" "My late husband's papers," Lisi said, spinning her opened pack of Salem Lights on the coffee table in front of her. She realized that she once again had cigarettes and no fire. Perhaps it was a warning that she should give the habit up again after all, before it could settle its little yellow hooks back into her brainstem. She thought of adding, "I'm sure he'll want to talk to me," and didn't bother. His wife would know that. "Just a moment, please." Lisi waited. She hadn't planned what she was going to say. This was in accordance with another of Landon's rules. You only planned out what you were going to say for disagreements. When you were really angry, when you wanted to tear someone a new asshole, as the saying was, it was usually best to just rear back and let it rip. So she sat there, mind a careful blank, spinning her pack of cigarettes. Around and around it went. At last, a smooth, masculine voice she thought she remembered said, "Hello, Mrs. Landon. This is a pleasant surprise." "Sawiza," she thought. "Sawiza, baby love." "No," Lisi said, "it's not going to be pleasant at all." There was a pause, then, cautiously, "I beg pardon? Is this Lisa Landon? Mrs. Scott Listen to me, you son of a bitch. There's a man harassing me. I think he's a dangerous man. Yesterday he threatened to hurt me. Mrs. Landon, in places I didn't let the boys touch at the junior high school dances was how he put it, I think. And tonight, Mrs. Landon, tonight, he left a dead cat in my mailbox and a letter stuck in my door. And the letter had a telephone number on it, this number. So don't tell me you don't know what I'm talking about when I know you do." On the last word, Lisi batted the pack of cigarettes with the side of her hand, batted it like a badminton birdie. It flew all the way across the room, shedding Salem Lights as it went. She was breathing hard and fast, but with her mouth wide open. She didn't want Woodbody to hear her doing it and mistake her rage for fear. Woodbody made no reply. Lisi gave him time. When he still didn't talk, she said, "Are you there? You better be." She knew it was the same man who replied, but the smooth, round lecture hall tones were gone. This man sounded both younger and somehow older. "I'm going to put you on hold, Mrs. Landon, and take this in my study. Where your wife can't hear is what you mean. Hold on, please. It better not be long, Wood Smucky, or—" There was a click, then silence. Lisi wished she had used the cordless phone in the kitchen. She wanted to pace around, maybe snag one of her cigarettes and light it off a stove burner. But maybe this was better. This way she couldn't blow off any of her rage. This way she had to stay strapped so tight it hurt. 10 seconds went by, 20, 30. She was preparing to hang up when there was another click on the line, and the king of the incunks spoke to her again in his new young old voice. It had picked up a funny little hiccuping tremor. It's his heartbeat, she thought. It was her thought, but it could have been Scott's insight. His heart's beating so hard I can actually hear it. I wanted to scare him, I scared him. Now why should that scare me? And yes, all of a sudden she was scared. It was like a yellow thread weaving in and out of the bright red overblanket of her rage. "Mrs. Landon, is he a man named Dooley? James or Jim Dooley? Tall and skinny, with a little bit of a hill accent, like Westford. I don't know his name. He called himself Zach McCool on the phone, and that's the name he signed to his... Fuck, Woodbody said. Only he stretched it out. Fuck, and turned it into something almost incantatory. It was followed by a sound that might have been a groan. In Lisi's mind, a second bright yellow thread joined the first. What? She asked sharply. That's him, Woodbody said. It has to be. The email address he gave me was Zach991. You told him to scare me into giving you Scott's unpublished papers, didn't you? That was the deal. Mrs. Landon, you don't understand. I think I do. I've dealt with some fairly crazy people since Scott died, and the academics put the collectors to shame, but you make the rest of the academics look normal, Woodsmucky. That's probably why you were able to hide it at first. The really crazy people have to be able to do that. It's a survival skill. Mrs. Landon, if you'll only let me I'm being threatened, and you're responsible. You don't need to explain that. So listen up, and listen up good. Call him off right now. I haven't given your name to the authorities yet, but I really think the police getting your name is the least of your worries. If I get one more call, one more letter, or one more dead animal from this deep space cowboy, I'll go to the newspapers. Inspiration struck. I'll start with the ones in Pittsburgh. They'll love it. Crazed academic threatens famous writer's widow. When that shows up on page one, a few questions from the cops in Maine will be the least of your problems. Goodbye, tenure. Lisi thought all of this sounded good, and it hid those yellow threads of fear, at least for the moment. Unfortunately, what Woodbody said next brought them back again, brighter than ever. You don't understand, Mrs. Landon. I can't call him off. 5. For a moment, Lisi was too flabbergasted to speak. Then she said, What do you mean, you can't? I mean, I've already tried. You have his email address, Zach999 or whatever it was. Zach991@sale.com, for what it's worth. Might as well be 000. It doesn't work. It did the first couple of times I used it, but since then my emails just bounce back marked cannot deliver. He began babbling about trying again, but Lisi hardly paid attention. She was replaying her conversation with Zach McCool, or Jim Dooley if that was his real name. He'd said Woodbody was either going to telephone him or... Do you have some special email account? She asked, interrupting Woodbody in mid-flow. He said you were going to email him in some special way and tell him when you'd gotten what you wanted. So where is it? Your university office, an internet cafe? No, Woodbody nearly wailed. Listen to me, of course I have an email address at Pitt, but I never gave it to Dooley. It would have been insane. I have 2 grad students who regularly access the mail there, not to mention the English department secretary. And at home? I gave him my home email address, yes, but he's never used it. What about the phone number you have for him? There was a moment of silence on the line, and when Woodbody spoke again, he sounded honestly puzzled. This scared her worse still. She looked at the wide living room window and saw that the sky in the northeast was turning lavender. It would soon be night. She had an idea this might be a long one. Phone number? Woodbody said. He never gave me a phone number. Just an email address that worked twice, then quit. He was either lying or fantasizing. Which do you think it was? Woodbody nearly whispered. I don't know. Lisi thought this was Woodbody's chicken shit way of trying not to admit what he really thought, that Dooley was crazy. Hold on a minute. She started to put the handset down on the sofa, then thought better of it. You better be there when I get back, Professor. There was no need to use one of the stove burners after all. There were long decorative matches for lighting the fireplace in a brass cuspidor next to the fire tools. She picked a Salem light up off the floor and scraped one of the long matches alight on a hearthstone. She took one of the ceramic vases for a temporary ashtray, laying aside the flowers that had been in it and reflecting, not for the first time either, that smoking was one of the world's nastier habits. Then she went back to the sofa, sat down, and picked up the phone. Tell me what happened. Mrs. Landon, my wife and I have plans to go out. Your plans have changed, Lisi said. Start at the beginning. 6. Well, of course, in the beginning were the Inkunks, those pagan worshippers of original texts and unpublished manuscripts, and Professor Joseph Woodbody, who was their king as far as Lisi was concerned. God knew how many scholarly articles he'd published concerning the works of Scott Landon, or how many of them might even now be quietly gathering dust in the booksnake above the barn. Nor did she care how badly tormented Professor Woodbody had been by the thought of the unpublished works that might also be gathering dust in Scott's study. What mattered was that Woodbody made a habit of having 2 or 3 beers 2 or 3 evenings a week on his way home from campus, always at the same bar, a place called The Place. There were plenty of college-type drinking establishments near Pitt, some of them by the pitcher beer dives, some of them the smart bars where faculty and class-conscious grad students went to drink, the kind of places with spider plants in the windows and Bright Eyes on the jukebox instead of My Chemical Romance. The Place was a working man's bar a mile from the campus, and the closest thing to rock on the jukebox was a Travis Tritt-John Mellencamp duet. Woodbody said he liked going there because it was quiet on weekday afternoons and early evenings, also because the ambiance made him think of his father, who had worked in one of U.S. Steel's rolling mills. Lisi didn't give a sweet smuck about Woodbody's father. It was in this bar that he had met the man who called himself Jim Dooley. Dooley was another late afternoon, early evening drinker, a soft-spoken fellow who favored blue chambray work shirts and the kind of dickies with cuffs that Woodbody's father had worn. Woodbody described Dooley as about 6'1", lanky, slightly stooped, with thinning dark hair that often tumbled over his brow. He thought Dooley's eyes had been blue, but wasn't sure, although they had drunk together over a period of 6 weeks and had become what Woodbody described as sort of buddies. They had exchanged not life stories, but patchwork pieces of life stories, as men do in bars. For his part, Woodbody claimed to have told the truth. He now had reasons to doubt that Dooley had done the same. Yes, Dooley might well have drifted down to the Berg from West Virginia 12 or 14 years ago, and probably had worked a series of low-paying manual labor jobs since then. Yes, he might have done some prison time. He had that institutional look about him, always seeming to glance up into the back bar mirror as he reached for his beer, always looking back over his shoulder at least once on his way to the men's. And yes, he might really have come by the scar just above his right wrist during a brief but vicious fight in the prison laundry. Or not. Hey, maybe he had just tripped over his trike when he was a kid and landed wrong. All Woodbody knew for sure was that Dooley had read all of Scott Landon's books and was able to discuss them intelligently. And he listened sympathetically to Woodbody's tale of woe concerning the intransigent widow Landon, who was sitting on an intellectual treasure trove of unpublished Landon manuscripts, a completed novel among them, according to rumor. But sympathy was really too mild a word. He had listened with growing outrage. According to Woodbody, it was Dooley who had started calling her Yoko. Woodbody characterized their meetings at the place as occasional, bordering on regular. Lisi parsed this intellectual bullshit and decided it meant Woodbody-Dooley bitch-fests about Yoko Landon 4 and sometimes 5 afternoons a week, and that when Woodbody said a beer or two, he probably meant a pitcher or two. So there they were, this intellectual Oscar and Felix, getting soused just about every weekday afternoon, at first talking about how great Scott's books were, and then progressing naturally to what a miserable withholding bitch his widow had turned out to be. According to Woodbody, it was Dooley who had turned their conversations in this direction. Lisi, who knew how Woodbody sounded when he was denied what he wanted, doubted if it had taken much effort. And at some point, Dooley had told Woodbody that he, Dooley, could persuade the widow to change her mind about those unpublished manuscripts. After all, how hard could it be to talk sense to her when the man's papers were almost certainly going to end up at the University of Pittsburgh Library with the rest of the Landon collection anyway? He was good at changing people's minds, Dooley said. He had a knack for it. The king of the Inkunks, looking at his new friend with a drunk's bleary shrewdness, Lisi had no doubt, asked Dooley how much he'd want for such a service. Dooley had said he wasn't looking to make a profit. They were talking about a service to mankind, weren't they? Prying a great treasure away from a woman who was too stupid to understand what it was she was sitting on, like a broody hen on a clutch of eggs. Well, yes, Woodbody had responded, but the workman was worthy of his hire. Dooley considered this and said he'd keep a record of his various expenses. Then, when they got together and he transferred the papers to Woodbody, they could discuss the matter of payment. And with that, Dooley had extended his hand over the bar to his new friend, just as if they had closed a deal which actually made sense. Woodbody had taken it, feeling both delighted and contemptuous. He had gone back and forth in his mind about Dooley during the 5 or 7 weeks he'd known him, he told Lisi. There were days when he thought Dooley was a serious hard-ass, a self-made jailhouse scholar whose blood-chilling stories of stick-ups and fights and spoon-handle knifings were all true. Then there were days, the day of the handshake being one of them, when he was positive that Jim Dooley was nothing but talk, and the most dangerous crime he'd ever committed was stealing a gallon or two of paint thinner out of the Walmart in Monroeville where he'd worked for 6 months or so in 2004. So for Woodbody, it had been little more than a half-drunk joke, especially when Dooley more or less told him he was going to talk Lisi out of her dead husband's papers for the sake of art. That, at least, was what the king of the Incunks told Lisi on that afternoon in June. But of course, this was the same king of the Incunks who had sat half-drunk in a bar with a man he hardly knew, a self-confessed hard-time con, the two of them calling her Yoko and agreeing that Scott must have kept her around for one thing and one thing only, because what else could he have wanted her for? Woodbody said that, as far as he was concerned, the whole thing had been little more than a joke, just two guys blue-skying in a bar. It was true that the two guys in question had exchanged email addresses, but these days everybody had an email address, didn't they? The king of the Incunks had met his loyal subject just one more time following the day of the handshake. That had been 2 afternoons later. Dooley had limited himself to just a single beer on that occasion, telling Woodbody that he was in training. After that one beer, he'd slid off his bar stool, saying he had an appointment to see a fella. He also told Woodbody he'd probably meet him the following day, next week for sure. But Woodbody had never seen Jim Dooley again. After a couple of weeks, he'd stopped looking. And the Zach 991 email address stopped working. In a way, he thought, losing track of Jim Dooley was a good thing. He had been drinking too much, and there was something about Dooley that was just wrong. Figured that out a little late, didn't you? Lisi thought sourly. Woodbody's drinking dropped back to its previous level of 1 or 2 beers a week, and without even really thinking about it, he moved to a bar a couple of blocks away. It didn't occur to him until later, until my head cleared, was how he put it, that he was unconsciously putting distance between himself and the last place he'd seen Dooley, that he had, in fact, repented of the whole thing. If, that was, it had ever been anything other than a fantasy, just one more Jim Dooley air castle which Joe Woodbody had helped to furnish while drinking away the waning weeks of another miserable Pittsburgh winter. And that was what he had believed, he finished, summing up as earnestly as a lawyer whose client faces lethal injection if he screws up. He had come to the conclusion that most of Jim Dooley's stories of banditry and survival at Brushy Mountain had been complete fabrications, and his idea of getting Mrs. Landon to give up her late husband's manuscripts was just one more. Their deal had been nothing but a child's game of what if. "If that's true, tell me something," Lisi said. "If Dooley had shown up with a truckload of Scott's stories, would that have kept you from taking them?" "I don't know." That, she thought, was actually honest, and so she asked him something else. "Do you know what you've done? What you've set in motion?" To this, Professor Woodbody said nothing, and she thought that was also honest. As honest, maybe, as he was capable of being. 7. After a pause to think, Lisi said, "Did you give him the number where he called me? Do I have you to thank for that, too?" "No, absolutely not. I didn't give him any number, I promise you." Lisi believed him. "You're going to do something for me, Professor," she said. "If Dooley gets in touch with you again, maybe just to tell you he's hot on the trail and things are looking good, you're going to tell him the deal's off, totally off." "I will." The man's eagerness was almost abject. "Believe me, I..." He was interrupted by a woman's voice, his wife's, Lisi had no doubt, asking something. There came a rustling sound as he covered the bottom part of the telephone with his hand. Lisi didn't mind. She was adding up her situation here and not liking the total. Dooley had told her she could turn off the heat by giving Woodbody Scott's papers and unpublished manuscripts. The professor would then call the madman, tell him everything was cool, and that would be that. Only the former king of the Incunks claimed he no longer had any way of getting in touch with Dooley, and Lisi believed him. Was it an oversight on Dooley's part? A glitch in his planning? She didn't think so. She thought that Dooley really might have some vague intention of showing up at Woodbody's office, or suburban castle, with Scott's papers. But before he did, he planned to first terrorize her and then hurt her in places she'd never let the boys touch at the junior high school dances. And why would he do that? After going to such great lengths to assure both the professor and Lisi herself that there was a fail-safe system in place to keep bad things from happening if she cooperated? Maybe because he needs to give himself permission. That rang true. And later on, after she was dead maybe, or so grotesquely maimed she wished she were dead, Jim Dooley's conscience would be able to assure itself that Lisi herself had been to blame. I gave her every chance, her friend Zack would think. It was nobody's fault but her own. She had to be Yoko to the bitter end. Okay. Okay, then. If he showed up, she'd just give him the keys to the barn and the study and tell him to take whatever he wanted. I'll tell him to knock himself out, have a ball. But at this thought, Lisi's lips thinned into the humorless moon smile perhaps only her sisters and her late husband, who called it Lisi's tornado look, would have recognized. A smuck I will, she muttered, and looked around for the silver spade. It wasn't there. She'd left it in the car. If she wanted it, she'd better go out and get it before it got completely dark. Mrs. Landon. It was the professor, sounding more anxious than ever. She'd forgotten all about him. Are you still there? Yeah, she said. This is what it gets you, you know. I beg pardon? You know what I'm talking about. All the stuff you wanted so bad, the stuff you thought you had to have, this is what it gets you. How you feel right now. Plus the questions you'll have to answer when I hang up, of course. Mrs. Landon, If the police call you, I want you to tell them everything you've told me, which means you better answer your wife's questions first, don't you think? Mrs. Landon, please. Woodbody sounded panicky now. You bought into this, you and your friend Dooley. Stop calling him my friend. Lisi's tornado look grew stronger, the lips thinning until they showed the tops of her teeth. At the same time, her eyes narrowed until they were no more than blue sparks. It was a feral look, and it was all DeBuscher. But he is, she cried. You're the one who drank with him and told him your tale of woe and laughed when he called me Yoko Landon. You were the one who set him on me, whether you said it in so many words or not. And now it turns out he's just as crazy as a shithouse rat, and you can't pull him off. So yes, Professor, I'm gonna call the county sheriff, and yes, sirree, I'll be giving them your name. I'll be giving them anything that'll help them find your friend. Because he's not done. You know it, and so do I. Because he doesn't want to be done. He's having a good smucking time, and this is what it gets you. You bought it, you own it. Okay? Okay? No answer. But she could hear the wet sound of breathing, and she knew the former king of the Incunks was trying not to cry. She hung up, snagged another ciggy off the floor, lit it. She went back to the telephone, then shook her head. She'd call the sheriff's office in a minute. First, she wanted to get the silver spade out of the beamer, and she wanted to do it right away, before all the light was gone and her part of the world swapped day for night. 8. The side yard, which she supposed she'd go to her grave thinking of as the door yard, was already too dark for comfort, although Venus, the wishing star, had yet to make her appearance in the sky. The shadows where the barn joined the tool shed were especially dark, and the BMW was parked less than 20 feet from there. Of course, Dooley wasn't hiding in that well of shadows, and if he was on the place, he might be anywhere, leaning against the changing hut by the pool, peering around the corner of the house where the kitchen was, crouched behind the cellar bulkhead. Lisi whirled on her heels at that idea, but there was still enough light to see there was nothing on either side of the bulkhead. And the bulkhead doors themselves were locked, so she didn't have to worry about Dooley in the cellar. Unless, of course, he'd broken into the house somehow and hidden down there before she got home. Stop it, Lisa, you're creeping yourself out. She paused, with her fingers curled around the handle of the BMW's rear door. She stood that way for maybe 5 seconds, then let her cigarette drop from her free hand and stamped out the butt. There was someone standing in the deep angle where the barn and the tool shed met, standing there very tall and still. Lisi opened the Beamer's rear passenger door and snatched out the silver spade. The light inside the car stayed on when she closed the door again. She'd forgotten that, how the inside lights of cars now stayed on for a little while, the courtesy light, they called it. But she found nothing courteous about the idea that Dooley could see her and she could no longer see him, thanks to the way that smucking light was screwing up her vision. She stepped away from the car, holding the shaft of the spade diagonally across her breasts. The light inside the BMW finally went out. For a moment, that made things worse. She could see only a world of indistinct purple shapes under the fading lavender sky, and she fully expected him to leap out at her, calling her Mrs. and asking why she hadn't listened as his hands closed around her throat and her breath rattled to an end. It didn't happen, and in another 3 seconds or so, her eyes readapted to the low light. Now she could see him again, tall and straight, grave and still, standing there in the angle of the big building and the small one, with something at his feet. Some kind of square package. It could have been a suitcase. Good God, he doesn't think he can get all of Scott's papers in there, does he? She thought, and took another cautious step to her left, holding the silver spade so tightly that her fists throbbed. Zach, is that you? Another step, two, three. She heard a car coming and understood that its headlights were going to sweep the yard, revealing him fully. When that happened, he would leap at her. She swung the silver spade back over her shoulder just as she had in August of 1988, finishing her wind-up as the approaching car breasted Sugar Top Hill, flooding her yard with momentary light and revealing the power mower she herself had left in the angle of the barn and the shed. The shadow of its handle leaped upward on the side of the barn, then faded as the car's headlights faded. Once more, the lawnmower could have been a man with a suitcase at his feet, she supposed, although once you'd seen the truth. In a horror movie, she thought, this is where the monster would leap out of the darkness and grab me, just as I'm starting to relax. Nothing leaped out to grab her, but Lisi didn't think it would hurt to take the silver spade inside with her, if only for good luck. Carrying it in one hand now, down by the collar where the shaft met the silver scoop, Lisi went to call Norris Ridgwick, the Castle County Sheriff.